Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
Dr. Redmond.
And we are here for the big 200th episode of Criminal Minds, which, wrap your head around that one. We have reviewed 200 episodes worth of this show. And one spinoff. Only when you get to episode 200 do you realize, oh boy, have we've been already doing this for a while, haven't we?
Oh yeah. There are days when I think too long, but this week isn't one of them. I mean,
no, absolutely.
Well, episode two, we'll get to episode 200, but you know, I mean, it's, the only thing that I came up when I finished watching these three episodes, I thought, you know, maybe that's the clue to having tighter episodes. Is this, tell them they don't have any money and all their episodes have to be sort of in a box, you know?
Because and we got, you know, three episodes in a row that were kind of okay. And then we were like, you know what? Maybe it was the crunch of working with that made these episodes so solid.
Well,
maybe
we were
it was
thinking,
that dictate.
Well,
yeah,
we were thinking, but it can sort of continues on sort of, you
it
know,
does. But you know what? We'll get there. First off, I just want to say that I'm pretty excited to look at this one, and I'm going to mention something and remind me to ask you about what's going on with that Anderson character when we get to episode 200, because that's a little weird. We're not there yet, though, so let's start off with episode 199.
The road.
913.
Yes, the road home.
Okay.
With Rossi searching Los Angeles, California for his former Marine Corps Sergeant, Meshach Taylor, right?
Yep.
The remaining members of the BAU set out to track down a mission-oriented Cleveland, Ohio vigilante. Meanwhile, JJ continues to keep the team from discovering her secret. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's right.
No, that does happen. Like, that's not completely bonkers.
Actually, in the two episodes where they use meanwhile,
they're actually
correctly used.
Well, that's nice.
Just thought, I noticed that when I was looking
absolutely.
At the third episode. Anyway, so that's the episode. It was a good episode.
For the show trying and failing once again to grapple with vigilantism, yes. Absolutely, I call this a good episode of Criminal Minds. And I mean,
even,
you know, I normally say, well, grading on a curve. Like, no, it's just a solid episode of television.
Yeah.
And the weird part is, it's the rare episode that spends a ton of time with the killer.
Yeah.
Because they've found a guy who you can be on side with, right?
Yeah.
You don't mind that they're spending this much time with the killer. And we've talked before about how hard it is to make vigilantism seem morally wrong.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it really is difficult to make vigilantism seem morally wrong, especially within the framework that this show is operating. And this episode is a perfect example of it, because they need to, by the end of the episode, make him seem like he's in some way a bad guy, when all he's been doing is shooting criminals and the audience is definitely going to be on his side, right? That's just what happens. So you're like, well, how do we make him seem like a bad guy? And so the closest they can do is have the most preposterous thing in the world happen.
Yeah.
Which is, he accidentally shoots a guy's brother instead of that guy, but it only happens
because that guy buys his brother's house.
No, not just buys his brother's house. Because he walks up to the door and says, "Are you Mr. Stevenson?"
Yeah. And
like,
yeah.
No on earth would say, "Are you Mr. Stevenson?" You know his name is Greg Stevenson. You would say, "Are you Greg Stevenson?" He would say,
"No." I think it's Milo Stevenson or
whatever
something. But anyway,
it doesn't
matter
what the name is.
Yeah.
No, I'm using fake names. But the thing is, he would say, "No, I'm not Greg Stevenson. I'm his brother Phil. He moved to Hawaii. Can I help you?"
Yeah,
that is what would happen in that scene.
No, it's
in real life.
They had to find some way to, you know, and I mean, that goes to my position that which is, I can forgive a lot in episodes.
Yeah,
when you end on the right note.
Well, And the thing
is, in this case, you just listen to this and you just go, oh, frig, you guys. Yeah. You couldn't find a better way out of this.
I know, right?
Why didn't you just let him fall apart, having killed all of the people that he needed to kill, plus the few horrible bad guys? And then, yes, they can comment. And then the comment from the team would be, look, you know, it's wrong. You have to, this is where the team has their moral quandary.
Yep.
Because they, like the audience,
they're fine that he's killing they don't have a huge problem with the people he's killing, but, and this is the key, all you have to do is at the end of the episode, right? Just have them say, well, you don't have this easy out. Oh, well, he killed the wrong guy. No, don't give the show an easy out. Just have him have only killed people who in one way or another had it coming. And then, and this is the key part, he's still angry. Right? He's still angry. He's still furious. He's still full of hate. And he goes and he visits the mother. And then the team can say, like, is this worth it anymore? Like, are you getting anything out of this anymore? Does she need to die? And if you kill her, is that going to make it feel better?
Yeah. No. I mean, you have the moral quandary, right? You just leave the moral quandary sitting there. And then if they had said that to him.
Yeah, he still would have killed himself.
He still would have killed himself.
No, but this contrived nonsense where he kills the wrong person.
What makes him kill himself?
That's what makes him kill himself. No, it spoils a really strong episode.
Yeah.
Like, need to make this about the moral question of whether it's fine for him to be doing it. And it's like, how far should this revenge stretch?
And the thing is,
once he gets to this woman, it's like, well, you're not really trying to avenge your wife anymore. You're just wallowing in hate.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a strong moment.
Yeah.
But the show doesn't get it.
No, the show just... Well, no, but that is because of the showrunner and the writers.
Yes, you're right.
Because you did have moral quandaries in the beginning.
That's true.
Right? In that first bunch of episodes, like first few years, you did have them dealing with moral quandaries. I'm not saying they always dealt them with them well or anything else. I mean, you can all, but compared to what's happening now, which is like they want an easy out all the time, and that's what this is.
Yep.
You have such a strong episode because the part with Meshach Taylor, with Rossi, right, and his sergeant is just like a brilliant little piece.
Oh no, it's a really nice little story with the two of them. Like, that's a very good scene.
Like all of that works, and this would have worked if they had just tried to talk him out of killing this woman, and he gets it and he kills himself.
Yep.
Fine. But to go on this thing, why? Because the audience, you know, what do you think? I mean, the audience,
audience can't understand? But that's the thing. It's like, do you think the audience can't understand the moral difference between shooting a bunch of meth dealers and a bunch of street criminals and an abusive husband and shooting a woman whose son killed your wife?
Yeah.
Like, the audience can understand the difference there.
Maybe
there's a moral difference.
Yeah. And there is, but the problem is, I mean, basically it comes down to the showrunner the showrunner doesn't have a moral compass. We've discussed that before. She doesn't. Her only, her only moral compass is money, I think, or keeping this show on the air. And once Asshole was gone, the show ended.
I think that's a strong point. Although I think they're, we've talked about this before, how the days of the show were always going to number just based on
but you should hear the commentary.
Really?
On the commentary for 200. I'll talk
to you about that. We'll talk about the commentary in 200 when we get there. But yeah, I think overall, except for the one completely contrived thing in order to get the, you know, to to let everybody off the hook. And it's like, no, you shouldn't have enjoyed his actions because he was just a monster. Except for that scene. This is a very strong episode.
Yeah.
John Grease is fantastic in it.
Oh, yes.
I mean, we love him anyway. He was one of the stars of The Pretender. And if you haven't seen The Pretender, you owe it to yourself to check out The Pretender. Just a truly fun action thriller from the 1990s, which was just great.
hard to get, though.
Really hard to find. And
well, it's very, very expensive, and I still think it comes, and some of it seems to come from China, which means that somebody videotaped it.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of shows from the 1990s, and this is true, where huge numbers of people taped it or used early video discs, and whoever the distributor is, because this is the last gasp, right, before all of TV production started being made by the people who were airing it. They got rid of, in the 1990s, they got rid of the last of anti-consolidation laws in America. So up until the 1990s, basically, people made TV shows and then TV networks bought TV shows, right? Yeah. And after the late 1990s, TV networks just made all of their own TV shows. So it's all just anti-competitive nonsense. It was just a way to bust unions and destroy independent producers. And that's a conversation you can have at a later time.
Yeah, it has no bearing on this episode.
No, it's
not,
but it is relevant it's relevant in this case.
Yeah.
Because that means there's all these TV shows from the 90s, right? Yeah. And all these TV shows from the 90s, who the hell knows who owns the rights to it?
Yeah.
Like, who owns the rights to The Pretender? I doubt, like, I'm sure NBC has some rights, but they're not the ones who bought it. They're not the ones who paid all of the actors. So it's like, if you wanted to release it on DVD, you would have to unwind this ridiculous set of rights. And that's why the only things that end up on DVD are things that are so popular that it's worth doing that. All of these marginal shows, they don't even bother putting them on streaming services because it is so much of a hassle to unwind the rights.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened with Sisters, because remember we
bought
that.
That's exactly what happened with Sisters. Yeah, we bought had to that get illegal Chinese DVDs or Eastern European DVDs that, as you said, was just someone had taped the show and now they were putting it out on DVD because who the hell knows? But if you got a friend who really wants to see the show Sisters, there's only one way to get it to them, and that sucks.
Yeah.
I mean, try to watch 30-something today. You can't do it.
Yeah.
It's all the stuff is just gone because it's so hard to unwind the rights.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so hard to find The Pretender, which is, and I want to say, a really good show. And it starred John Grease and, oh God, I'm trying to remember her name. Andrea Parker. And who was the lead? Michael T. Weiss.
Yeah. Because I remember he used to love going to Toronto. He said that during that time because you would see him because he would hang around Toronto.
Yes.
And nobody would bother him. Like, people would recognize him and they would nod at him and he would smile back, but nobody bothered him in Toronto.
Yeah. It's like the Canadian deal. The Canadian relationship with celebrity is much different than the American relationship.
And by the way, Jerry O'Connell's new show that I told you about last year, I think Harley or something. Anyway, it's got a second season and it started.
Jerry O'Connell.
Yeah, last week. So I'm going, so Jerry's committed to being back home.
I'm really glad to hear that. Technically, he's not Canadian, but dear God, has he spent most of his career working in Canada.
I know, well, he seems to like it, and he seems terribly Canadian.
He does. He just seems so pleasant in that very Canadian way.
Yeah, well, but it's What's-His-Face came to back to do Private Eyes.
Oh, right.
You know, the guy from...
Oh, God. It's so embarrassing. Jason Priestley.
Beverly Hills
90210. Yeah. Jason Priestley came back to do Private Eyes. Well, and he had another show before that. He just famously likes being in Canada. But, we digress slightly. Sorry about that. But no, I mean, it's fundamentally, it is a good episode of the show. And if it didn't out when it counted, and I just want to point out, like, they let you know right away that, this guy's got to get shot, the abusive husband, because guess what? And this is something an unbelievable scumbag. And this is a fun fact, and this is why they used it as a shortcut. Basically, many studies have shown that the number one sign that that spousal abuse is going to escalate to murder is if you ever choke someone. Yeah. Like, choking is, well, first off, anytime you choke someone, there's a solid chance they might die. But a willingness to put your hands on and choke someone is the biggest indicator that this is going to escalate to murder.
Yeah.
So just think about that when you see this guy wrapping his hands around his wife's neck. And of course it's completely justifiable that John Grease shoots the guy. So yeah. It's a strong episode in a ton of ways.
Well,
it's
and the good part of that was, you know, I mean, because you had the potential. That's what made this such a potentially strong episode, because you have the ex-wife.
Yep.
There, just saying, no, I'm not telling you what he looks like. No, I'm not giving a statement. No,
isn't that nice?
He did me a favor.
Yep.
I will never turn him in, and I hope to God he gets away.
Wasn't that beautiful?
No, and it really was, because she was living that life that so many women live. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, protection. And like, I can never understand why people in this show, well, I guess the writers, I guess it's the message from on high. You have to make the whatever. But, you know, they're going, but, you know, you could get a protection order.
I know, right?
That was Jeannie, you know, what's her face?
Alex Blake.
Alex.
Yeah,
Jean, you know, Triple saying that to her, you know, and she just looks at them, but they're not the paper that the judge.
I know, writes it on. And more to the point, you already did an episode about how protective orders are useless. You've done episodes about how, like, protective orders don't really accomplish much. All they can do is shoo away a pest, because a pest will, you know, a guy who wasn't going to do anything bad, but is annoying to you, yeah, they'll get rid of him. But they'll just piss off the violent ones.
Yeah. I mean, this episode, as I said, had the potential to be one of the greats.
Yeah.
Because of the two parts. Like, because the whole episode with Rossi.
Yep.
The whole part of the episode that revolves around Rossi was very, very strong. And so much so that you did believe it at the end when
the sun turns up. Yeah.
Now the son still is having problems with his father,
of course.
But I'm sure his wife explained to him that he seems to be fine and his son has a right to a grandfather.
Yeah. It's a very good scene. You totally believe that from that character. Like, you see that he's still shattered by his relationship with his dad, but it's worth the effort. It's a very good scene. And I'm really sad that Meshach Taylor died soon after making this episode.
Yeah.
Because I actually would have liked to see more of their relationship.
Yeah. You know, like, as you say, I mean, and Joe Mantegna directed the episode.
Of course. Yeah.
Of course. And he did a
perfectly good job.
Oh, well, he always. He's
a strong workmanlike director. Yeah.
Again, when he works with someone that he knows and likes and has worked with before, he pulls it together and gives us a wonderful performance.
Yeah. No, the two of them are really good together.
Yeah.
You know, in all of their scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's really good. You're right. Like, when he, and the thing is, like, we joke about this being his retirement, and I think that's true to a certain extent, but you're absolutely right that this episode proves that, you know what, he's still got gas in the tank. You know, if he wants to do a good job, he can do a good job. It's just most of the time he doesn't care because, you know, it's just Criminal Minds.
Well, that's what it feels like sometimes. Yeah. And then sometimes I go, well, maybe it's not that you could say, I'd have to go back and say, yeah, because I look at some of the other people who are so embedded in this show. Like, I think that, for example, Matthew Gray Gubler has been phoning it in for quite a while.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, he's in the same position as Rossi. This makes him a lot of money. He's going to stick with this show he's pulling basically a Nathan Fillion. I swear to God, it will come up more because he takes more and more and more and more time off.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's the thing that interests me, and that is the behind-the-scenes story I would like to hear, which is, what is the story of him taking 6 episodes off a year? But you know what? We're going to talk about them when we get to those seasons. But yeah, it is interesting the amount of time he takes off, starting season 11.
Yeah, it is coming, and we have noticed it, for example, in his last episode, which just didn't have, he wasn't given the free rein or the money or whatever. Yeah. That was the first point where this business of the money for the show came up when he did the commentary. And if you listen to that commentary, and I'm sorry that the Ottawa Public Library doesn't have Criminal Minds in it.
Very disappointing.
Well, at one level, yes. But as you said, partly you're going, oh, okay. So.
Okay, sarah, sarah.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So, but yeah, yeah, this show, since Bernero left, has more shows that could have been good, and if you had just given them little fixes, they screw up so often at the end.
And that's the thing that we've talked about a lot, and I think this is a perfect example of it, is like, what makes it such a frustrating show is how many of the episode's problems mm-hmm. aren't difficult to fix.
No.
Like, there are so many episodes where you're like, one little change right there, boom, you got a good episode.
Yeah, this episode, for sure. Sometimes we do more
involved rewrites. But honestly, this episode, literally just take out him shooting that one guy.
Yeah.
And rewrite the ending, and you've got one hell of an episode.
In fact, it would have made more sense if he had just said, and the guy says to him, no, that's my brother.
And then he's
so disappointed. He's sitting in a bar drinking, and he gets
He gets a reason to do it. Yep. And he gets a reason. It's like, what am I supposed to do now?
One...
Oh, go after the mother. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's such an easy
fix. And then they have to talk him out of killing the mother, and then he kills
her. It doesn't even have to be his brother. You literally say, no, those are the people who used to own the house. I bought it 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And that's all that scene has
to
be.
That's all it has to be. This was so simple to make a great episode.
Yeah. And they just
Have had any complaints at all.
It's true. We would have had zero complaints about this episode had they done that.
Yeah.
So yeah, come on, guys. Get it together.
Yeah,
speaking of 200.
Jeez. Okay, let me read the synopsis.
Yeah.
When JJ and Cruz are reported missing and both disappearances are connected to a clandestine mission from their time at the State Department, the BAU secretly works with former SSA Emily Prentice in an attempt to rescue their missing colleagues.
Okay, so...
where do you start? Go on.
Where do you start? All right, so this is...
commentary, so I went through it twice.
Oh, I feel so sorry for you. This is not a good episode of the show. It's just not. It's funny, like, it's one of those things where casting tells you who the bad guy is. Oh, that's Hilo from Battlestar Galactica. I guess he's the bad guy, because they wouldn't pay him just to be in flashbacks.
And don't you remember when he was in,
Dollhouse? And,
Dollhouse, yeah.
Of course. Yeah, like, the,
I loved it.
Oh, no, yeah, Dollhouse was a great show. I completely agree with that. But yeah, it's like, he's been in a lot of things, you know? This is a well-known genre actor. Right?
And you just look at him and say,
he's the villain. He's the
bad
guy.
Yeah, he's the bad guy.
You know right away.
Yeah.
There's no other reason for him
him. I mean, all of his lines are bad guy lines right from the first time he meets JJ.
From the first time you meet him when he's working with her.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's some ridiculous stuff in this episode. We'll get there. But yeah, so the episode has this problem where it's like, we never really understood why JJ, right, mm-hmm. was, you know, why she had to go to work for the State Department.
Yeah.
Because she didn't have to go to the work for the State Department. CBS just wanted a new wanted to give Rachel Nichols a job. That's what was actually happening. She didn't have to go.
Yeah, we've covered that.
We've already covered that on the show. You can go back and listen to our talking about season 6. It's a very fascinating season for a ton of reasons.
Yeah.
But the point I'm getting at is, this episode, like, really does raise the question, why on earth would they want this random woman who works finding cases for the four profilers? Because remember, at the time, she has no profiling training when she gets this job. Why on earth would they like, no, you've got to go to Afghanistan and work with people hunting for bin Laden? Like, it's just, there's no logic to it.
No, it made no sense. No, I just hand out the assignments.
Yeah, like, that's, you're right. You just, like, why are you here? You have no applicable skills. And they try to make it so that they give her applicable skills and that she's good at working with family members of murder victims. She is, but there's a million people who also can do that, and she is not famously the best at that.
Well, no, but the question is, she's not working with a murder victim's family here.
No, she's work, and I mean, she just it's not like they bring her, and she was already working there. She already had a job.
And why would this woman empathize or be, why would a tall, beautiful, blonde-haired, skinny woman from the United States be seen to be capable of interacting with the wife?
Yeah. The wife of a terrorist. Yeah, I know. No, this is not who you would pick for this job.
Yeah.
It's just, she doesn't even speak the language.
No. Like, if she spoke Arabic.
Yeah, if she spoke whatever they, I don't know if they speak Arabic or Farsi. I don't know what they speak in Afghanistan. I'm sorry,
well, no,
I don't.
Afghanistan.
Yeah, they have their own languages. I don't know what they're called, okay? I'm not going to pretend that I do. No. But the point is, she doesn't speak the local language.
Like, there's
Why would you think she should have this job?
I don't know who thought that this. Oh, well, I do know in the commentary. So.
Oh, you do know?
Yes.
How this happened? Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because they wanted to give JJ something important to do. Erica.
Well, what's funny is that it's like, this is exactly when they, after season, when they were like, who's coming back, who's not coming back, after season six, that's also what they did with Hotch. They sent him to Afghanistan. They had already done this with a different character. Although you can believe it more with him because he actually does manage a team, right? He has, so you can see that he would be in charge of an investigation there.
Yeah.
Like, that's more believable than her being recruited to do
this. For this job. It was nice to see Erin Strauss again.
Oh yeah, it was so great to see her briefly.
Yeah.
I was very happy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, once you, and you can't get over the premise of the show, like of this episode, that she's makes sense to be there. And the funny thing is, I mean, she does the acting job when she's being tortured and everything else.
It's perfect.
She does a great job of it. The problem is, I'm looking and going, but why is she here?
Yep.
Because she has these secret codes. Why the hell does she have these secret codes?
Why does she have secret codes? No, and the thing is, it's like, let's say you believe that she would have access to a secret code base while she was working in Afghanistan to try and catch bin Laden. Okay, that, I'm just going to accept that. That was 3 years ago. She doesn't still have access to those databases. Why would she?
And they would have changed those codes immediately.
Immediately. That's the
and
thing.
Not
like
given
they
it to
these
her because she wasn't
the
working
time.
There anymore. But and so they cover that up by saying, yeah, well, secretly she was still working for the State Department.
Of course she wasn't. Of course she wasn't.
The whole thing.
It's
like,
so ludicrous.
The whole show is just ludicrous that all you can do is just look at it and go, and they have her lose a baby. And
I know.
And they have Cruz being in love with her.
Well, not in love with her, but okay, close enough. But yeah.
Close
like,
enough. Come on.
No, I agree with you. But here's the, you want to know the craziest part? The craziest part is the scene where they're like, why would you hire an Iraqi, like an Iraqi Republican Guard torturer to be your translator in Afghanistan. And then they're like, oh my God, Cruz must be the villain. And because Cruz hired him personally. And then they're like, oh my God, Cruz must be the villain. But then it turns out Cruz isn't the villain. So, which leaves us with a pretty big question. Why did he hire an Iraqi Republican Guard torturer to be his translator?
I know. Like they put in this bizarre sort of red herring, right?
Yeah. That's like, they create all of this evidence to frame Cruz, but then Cruz had nothing to do with it. Like, what about all that evidence you found?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
You know, I just sort of sitting there and going, this was their 200th episode?
I know.
Okay. Oh. I'm sure that someone there thought this was just, well, I'm sure, and I know they did, because yeah. I listened to the commentary, and Erica thought this was just wonderful.
Oh,
and that, no, she, and I think that she, after listening to this, I'm going to just talk about the commentary, but after listening to this commentary, which was just, I mean, I thought that Matthew Gray Gubler was kind of phoning in his commentary, but he had some interesting things, and there were a few things he loved in it. And so you can listen.
You got that interesting insight about how things were, like, what was going on with the budget of the show. Absolutely.
Okay. So there were some things. But I'm listening to this commentary and, oh, good Lord. I mean, I mean, Candy Crush would have distracted, you know, I mean, from.
Would have been more engaging.
Yeah. And I listening to the commentary, but. And it's Erica Messer and it's JJ.
Of course. Yeah. AJ Cook.
AJ Cook. Right. The two of them. And AJ Cook wants this show to go on forever, which gives, that's the one insight I would say, is that I think that these people would have continued to work because she wanted it to continue for another 200 episodes. Right.
Aww.
But I do think that that these actors did become friends and work together very well. Right. And so they could continue because they don't see flaws in this. I mean, as I keep telling, Thomas Gibson is the only one who seemed to have cared about the plot.
Yeah.
Working or not working. And what happens here, right, Erica doesn't seem to understand that she just loves the fact that they've got those friggin' Humvees, right? And all of this other stuff.
They actually built a set for us out in the desert that actually looks like Afghanistan.
But they were really lucky because they could use, they just had to modify certain parts of the set.
Right.
Right? Like there's this, I can't even remember now, you know, that's how much I put it into my long-term memory. There wasn't much that was worth putting into my long-term memory. You know, I've got too much stuff in there already. So, you know, but what it was is that this, there had been a set that had been used for different shows, right? Simulating the Afghanistan experience.
Of course.
They're out in the desert and apparently the wind was blowing and all of this sand and stuff like that, but they had to modify a few things for them, et cetera. And then they got these great big, huge Humvees, right?
Right.
Oh, you know, that can resist the blasts. And
whatever you call it, mine-resistant vehicles. Yeah.
Yeah, IED-resistant vehicles, and they're really big and they're really heavy. And, you know, but you can see the things that excite Erica Messer.
Yeah. The stuff that makes it an exciting episode for her on. And
right?
And it's all production
sure stuff.
Still
isn't the plot. But she does, you know, but she wants... This was time for JJ to shine, basically, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think she gets, like, if you're looking at all of these things, like, I don't think that she and Padgett Brewster got along terribly well.
Really?
Like, no, I don't think that there's a dislike between them.
Okay.
Like, I don't think that there's any real dislike. I just think that
animus.
There's
I just love that word.
Pardon?
I just love the word animus.
Yeah, I don't think there's any animus or anything. I don't think there's, you know, particularly. I just think that there's...
You don't get the sense that they're close.
Or that she really liked her. I mean, she's handy, and I would assume the rest of the crew really, like the rest of the team, really liked having her back, these people. And right. she, of course, she and Matthew Gray Gubler are best friends. So all of those things are there, right? But it, you can just, you can hear what excites people when they're talking
when
on
they're
these
talking about it, absolutely.
And whatnot. And JJ would have loved, I mean, AJ Cook would have loved this series to go on forever. They have that little thing with Josh Stewart. They have this sort of name for him, but I'm going, oh, really? So, yeah.
Yeah, well, we all know where that's going.
Oh, Lord.
Well, it's just anytime we see her and Josh Stewart, we now know where it's going. So, we should have
it. You know, and then you see her with Matt, like it has, you know, it has.
Oh, it colors everything. Yeah, no, going back, as much as we try to engage with these episodes just as they are, it's hard not to let in the stuff we know that's coming. Because it, it colors everything. And the thing is, they did it in such a way that it colors every interaction the characters have going backwards.
Yeah.
And that is such a crucial mistake on their part that we're going to talk more about later.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Erica thought it was a good idea, I'm sure. Oh, yeah. But the thing is, yeah, and the thing is that, like, okay.
What's your big takeaway from my the commentary? Is that they were so excited to just do a war story and do a JJ story that they didn't really care about how little sense it made?
Yeah, like, yeah, I mean, when you go back, well, I mean, and it gave JJ a chance to... But the point is that there's something not believable about this year's JJ already.
Yeah.
Like, I've been noticing it over the episodes, and I wasn't thinking about it. It's not major, but I would see JJ sometimes, and I'm going, where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know, what's she turning into? Is her marriage going belly
south
up? Like,
or,
the,
yeah.
Oh, the big takeaway is she talks about her son.
Oh, okay.
Because it's her son that's playing
the Henry, Henry,
and how and what it was like. Henry got they shouldn't have brought him on the set for the end of it because he was very upset that his mother was upset.
Oh no!
Yeah, and she says, like to have allowed him to hang around when it wasn't his role, like when he didn't have the part.
When he didn't have to be on.
In other words, AJ Cook's husband should have come and picked Henry up.
Yeah, probably.
And not let him hang around the set because he got very upset. And that's what she says at one point near the end. That was
her
know.
Big takeaway.
That was her big takeaway. Okay.
Stressed out her kid too much.
Yeah, that was her big takeaway from this. But I mean, and she said it was very painful. She actually had shoulder damage that took weeks to heal.
Because they hanged her from the...
From the hanging, yeah.
Oh, damn.
And she said they really did do the waterboarding because they couldn't figure out any way to fake it.
Oh, my God. These people don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. They tried a couple of other things.
And it didn't look right, and she wasn't having the right reaction. So it's like, oh, let's just really waterboard her. What is wrong with you people?
Let's really give it a shot. And she says she has more respect for, you know, I mean, yeah, you got respect for the people who actually go through this. Well, yeah, but guess who gets waterboarded most? It ain't our guys that get waterboarded.
I know, right? Well, no, to be fair, our guys do get trained in waterboarding. But no, it's mostly, let's not forget that waterboarding, just in case it's not clear how we feel about this, is actual torture.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed to do it. And... You shouldn't have to have respect for people who go through it because it shouldn't be done.
Yeah. And, and she did talk to someone who had gone through the training of waterboarding.
The SEER training. Okay.
Yeah.
And to help get her in that headspace. Although I guess she didn't actually have to talk to that person to get in that headspace because then they actually waterboarded her.
That's what it appears. That's what it appears from the commentary.
God. Oh, that's
you know,
so
now I'm
horrifying.
Sure they didn't do full waterboarding.
Oh, no. But the thing is, it's like you say full partial, but the fact is, like, once they put that cloth over your face and start pouring water on it, no matter how pretend it is, you can't breathe and you feel like you're drowning. Mm-hmm. So
You know? Oh, she talks about that in the, like, JJ has more sort of to talk about just because it's her episode and her role in the rest of it. And it's interesting just for the mindset of the showrunner as well. Like, it's not at all like listening to Edward Bernero.
No.
When he did the odd commentary.
Yeah. Ben Bernero always seemed like he had a lot more going on.
Well, no, and he had a lot more. Yeah, like there's this sense. The sense I got from this was that, okay, so we just go from episode to episode and there's no real attempt to make consistency and continuity or something like this.
They just don't value because it.
You had to have given a reason for JJ to even be there in the first place. That's what just kind of.
And just they don't even care to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, in this episode does what the show does more than it really should, which is like, and this is what I really like about Mindhunter, what I really like about Unsub, things like that, is they understand that the FBI is working as part of a giant bureaucratic institution.
Yeah.
Whereas Criminal Minds, way too often, seems to be under the impression that, like, these eight people are the only people working on this stuff, and there's no one they can call for backup. Like, if an FBI agent has been kidnapped in Washington, D.C., you can just shut down the whole city.
Yeah.
You know? Two FBI agents were kidnapped inside the city, and they're like, there's no one we can go to for help. You can call everybody for help.
Yeah, you know, like, excuse me?
Two FBI agents have been kidnapped and said, shut down the city.
Yeah, well, now that we've decided what we're going to do between episode 9 and 10, we'll remember to see whether or not that they deal understand. With that. They understand.
No, but it's interesting because that's what one of the things I really liked about Unsub was, and I mean, you can say that, oh, well, that's the most boring stuff. You shouldn't have liked that. Them understanding that it's some of the conflict comes from having to work within a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, with not having unlimited resources, with not having a plane to fly you whenever, wherever you want at a moment's notice.
Yeah, to get you there for seconds. Oh, by the way, and to go back to the inside.
Yeah.
Right. They understood there was departmental problems.
Yep. But like whenever departmental problems come up on this show, and they do come up once or twice, it is always just the most contrived stuff.
Yeah.
Where it's like honestly, the way they frame it is, someone's got a problem with the BAU because they're too good at their job. And we only like mediocrity here at the FBI. And I'm like, what? And that's the problem with making these characters infallible people who catch one serial killer a week, 22 weeks out of the year. It's implausible to believe that anyone would ever have a problem with them. So when they need a higher up to have a problem with them, oh, well, that person's just a drunk. Or in season 13, that person's just a crazy person who has no reasons for anything she does.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. No, we're not going ahead yet. No, but this episode is worth mentioning here because this episode factors into that feeling.
Yeah.
Right? It really does. It factors into that because it's like these people, they're off on their own. Like he can get, like at the same time, we're asked to believe that Hotchner can just walk into a meeting with the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
And that the Secretary of State, who again, he can just walk into a meeting with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of State will be like, we don't care about your opinions. How did he get in here then? Like, it's this weird world where they're the most powerful and respected people in the entire government. But at the same time, whenever the script needs them to be, their concerns are completely dismissed and no one takes them seriously.
Well, yeah.
It's bizarre.
There's this need to sometimes set up fake. Like, it's conflict, almost a sign of the times. This was 2014, too. But this idea that somehow or another, the FBI and the CIA are at odds with one another all the time. as opposed to, and the State Department are at odds with one another as opposed to working together. They have two separate spheres of influence. Like, it's like they set up an idea about what government relationships are like in 2014 because they want to say they're in 2014.
Yeah.
Like they're not in an alternate timeline or anything. No. They're in the present timeline. So they're setting up that they're buying into this idea that
Obama's
somehow
the president, you know, like they're not living in a fictional world. This isn't 24.
No. And what happens is here, right? I mean, that's why we can be so hard on this show is because they want to set it in the real world.
Oh, absolutely.
And the thing is that by this time, this kind of thing that they're setting up has been slowly but surely broken down to some extent because of 9/11.
Yep.
Like 9/11 made some big changes. And with 9/11, one of the big takeaways, if it hadn't been a takeaway before and there had been other
signs that this was something they needed to work on.
And other reports that this was a problem. But after 9/11, it was taken seriously that
they have to work together all the time.
That these departments, if they had just been talking to one another, they might have potentially been able to even stop this because they knew some of this stuff. Like they
each different organization had their own pieces of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were never able to get together. Now, you know, what happened after 9/11 and everything else, we could go into a political stuff, but it affects this show because they're creating a false narrative. This would not have happened as good as Deborah Ferrantino was. Oh, Erica Messer was just raving about Deborah Ferrantino.
About getting Deborah Ferrantino there to play.
Well, she'd always wanted, she thought she was, but she'd never had a part that was good enough for her, is what she said.
That's a weird thing to say, because honestly, you could have just cast her as Alex Blake. You know?
But
and Ginny Triplehorn, but it's like, did we just find out that they offered her the, like, in that line, have we just found out that they offered her the Alex Blake part and she turned it down? Because she didn't want to do a TV show? Because, like, as an actor type, she and Ginny Triplehorn are the kind of people who are always up for the exact same parts.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that, again, she is the two of them, as I said, I could have seen them taking over the BAU before I saw Padgett Brewster taking over the BAU.
I know, right?
In season 12. But anyway, never mind.
Yeah.
But to get back, I mean, I don't know, you might be putting too much into that, but she was just raving about Deborah Barron in the commentary. But no, but it's setting up a world that really...
It just doesn't feel true to everything we know about how these organizations work.
No. And
especially because of how, like, all you have to do is say, like, look, we're she's saying we'll handle this and we're working on it. I'm like, but it's, why are you trying to isolate and not, like, why are you refusing to work together on this? Why aren't you? And we never see any proof that the State Department is doing anything. But it's a State Department server that's at risk, you know?
Yeah, you know, so it is a very bizarre sort of, but, you know, I mean, nobody bothers to think about those things when they write these episodes.
No,
we had these Humvees and we got to do blasts.
And we all went to a warehouse and had our team shooting it out with mercenaries. I'm
woo, woo, woo.
Come on.
It's like the end of what season was it? Season 4, season where they had the terrorist one, the other two.
Oh, 3 and 4, the end of season 3, the start of season 4, right.
Where you also had sort of these issues that you're just sort of sitting there going, okay, this isn't how it works, and you're trying to tell us that this is how it really works within this kind of, you know, and there aren't. Yeah.
So I think we can say that as with every time they get into terrorism and international super crime, they really dropped the ball this week.
Okay. And did maybe Erica Messer wanted to do this. Is that FBI? What was the foreign affairs one? Was it just called FBI?
Which one are you talking about?
Pardon?
Oh, God, yeah. What was the international? Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
Beyond Borders. Is that over by now?
Yeah, no, it went, well, yeah, of course it's over. They moved one of the cast members over to the main show. They canceled that show and they moved, whatever his name is, Daniel, over to the main show.
But he's not in the main show yet.
Yeah, no, not the Criminal Minds Beyond Borders went from, I think, season 11 of, like, was co-airing with season 11 and 12 of Criminal Minds.
Okay, so Beyond Borders.
And he comes over in season 13.
Okay, so then she's just moving into Beyond Borders.
Yeah, she's developing. No, I mean, not yet. I think she was developing Beyond Borders in season 10.
Okay, and so she probably, and that's because of this episode.
Yeah, she started thinking about how this is the kind of cool story she wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
About international intrigue and whatnot. And so, yeah, you're right. It wouldn't surprise me if working on this episode is what Erica Messer made her think she would want to do a spinoff about this kind of story all the time.
And what I would say is if they had kept Paget Brewster as running Interpol out of London,
that would have been a stronger kickoff for the show. Probably. Yeah, I don't think you're wrong about that.
Yeah.
But that's something we're going to talk about when we get around to watching
Beyond Borders.
Which, by the way, is going to be fun for me, because I've never seen one episode of Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
Oh, God. Well, I have. I thought...
Yeah, but don't say anything. It's fun, because, like, the rest of the Criminal Minds we've been watching, we're talking about it on our second viewing. But our episodes of Beyond Borders and our, you know, our episodes of this show about season 15 are going to be us watching stuff for the first time. So that should be a lot of fun.
Oh...
Okay, well, I use the term fun advisedly.
Yeah. You know, it's like my having to watch Taxi Driver and King of Comedy again. Yes, yeah. I will do it, but fun is not.
All right, so that was our look at episode 200, which ended up covering way more ground than I thought it would. Suffice to say that it is a mediocre episode of the show, and you're going to be very disappointed, like, 20 episodes from now, when they're unable to get Paul from Dollhouse back for the She Suffers PTSD episode, and everything kind of falls apart because they can't get back the actor they need.
Yeah. Anyway, okay.
Let's go.
Mr. and Mrs. Anderson. When two Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania women are strangled and subsequently found wrapped in a shower curtain, the BAU attempts to determine whether or not the crimes were committed by a two-person killing team. Meanwhile, Morgan and Garcia make Valentine's Day plans for their significant others, and JJ returns from her leave of absence.
Aww. I hope you liked Penelope's boyfriend. This is the last time you're ever going to be seeing him.
Yeah, well, I think they had to kind of give her a boyfriend and he has his still Savannah and
well, no, now that they're like developing a real relationship for Derek, they needed to give her a boyfriend to make her seem less sad. Cuz she's already, you know, screwed up the most important relationship of her life.
Yeah.
Because of her sick, codependent nonsense with Derek. And so they have to, well, now that we're actually going to get Derek a lady, what about Garcia?
And what about all of that horrible inter-office crap?
Stuff. So let's just get her a boyfriend and then never talk about her personal life again. but yes, this is the episode I was talking about the other day where they tried to do snow, and it leads to a hilarious scene. It's where they find this this guy's body in an alley, right? And so they like pile up a bunch of snow at the edge of the alley, and then you look down at where the body is laying, and you can see where all of the snow they had tried to put down had melted immediately. And in all the reverse angles looking up, you can see a great big leafy tree over their heads. And I'm like, come on, guys. Just set the episode in El Paso. It's fine. Your attempts to do snow are so embarrassingly bad. It's like, just set it in El Paso.
You know, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania does have a spring, summer, and fall.
I know. But no, they wanted to do, oh, we'll do the start of the episode. She's cold. She's at a, you know, gas station. She's freezing. So of course she's going to go with them. And I'm like, it gets cold at night in El Paso. It's fine. You know?
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't know why that is the one that really gets me, but they almost never attempted to do snow in the entire run of the show. They would always be like, okay, during the winter, like, we'll only do shows set in the Southwest or in Florida, whatever, and then the rest of the year we can do shows set wherever and nobody will notice. They're like, as you said, oh, we got some cash left over. Episode 200 wasn't as expensive as we thought. Let's just set one.
With snow.
With snow.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of Unsub. When they had to go to Vancouver, they just went to Vancouver.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're already filming in Vancouver, so let's just film it in Vancouver. Let's just admit we're in Vancouver. There you go.
Yeah,
we're already shooting there. Yeah, as Canal loved shooting in Vancouver, but that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. When Wise Guy did a lot of shooting in Vancouver, is the point.
Oh, Wise Guy did a lot.
Yeah, Wise Guy.
It was, and it was so good. Well, you did. Have you?
Well, after, like, and the thing is, they had to change the budget. I mean, we're going to talk about Wise Guy more in our Wise Guy podcast style section. I guess I thought I'd commit to that publicly.
Oh, I see.
Kind of,
so that's
kind of box us in is what I'm.
Because there is a sad part of Criminal Minds ending. When Criminal Minds ends, we're going to have to find something else to
talk about. Exactly. And my pitch is do a Wise Guy podcast called Style Section.
Well, we do love Wise Guy. And then we can all talk about the Tim Curry episodes.
Which, by the way, I should check if the Tim Curry episodes are on Amazon, because they might not be. Because they were never released on DVD. I still have my VHS copies.
Yeah.
It has, the Tim Curry episodes of Wise Guy have never been released anywhere.
It's crazy. It's sad. So we'll have to talk about them.
No, we'll talk all about that when we get there. But that's to talk about Style Section. For now, let's focus
Mr.
on this
and
episode.
Mrs. Anderson.
Yeah, and it's fun because it's weird. It's just a fun episode, although a line in there. It's just a fun episode. There's a couple of lines in there that bother me, but honestly, as an episode of Criminal Minds, they're doing
one Paul worked.
Bernardo style team killer, and it works.
and it works. And seeing them in the
marriage
when you first
office,
see them with marriage counselor, right?
Yeah. it's a juxtaposition. It works great.
What they're doing, and then they're in marriage counseling, and of course the marriage counselor is, so did it work? Well, maybe you should try that again. Well, I think we will.
Well, it's funny because what they've done is, there was this movie called Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which is a pretty garbage movie starring Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, which is remembered only because of the fact that they broke up the marriage. Yeah, and they ended up getting together. It broke up the Brad Pitt, Jennifer Aniston marriage. Yeah. Jennifer Aniston, when they worked together on this movie. And they were together for years and years and years and years. But that's where Brangelina started, is working on this movie, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And
he made a bigger mistake.
Obviously. But that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. What's interesting, though, about it is that the framework of that movie was that they were a couple who were both murderers, but they didn't know the other one was a murderer. And there's this framing device in the movie of them doing marriage counseling and, oh, I see how, like, they have to get together in their, you know, professional murdering to make their marriage work. And this episode's framing device is clearly a reference to that film, especially because of the way this episode is titled.
Yeah,
but I would argue that it worked right down to the title. It actually works better in this episode than it did in that movie.
Oh, this episode, Kimberly Ann Harrison wrote it, and Felix Apkala directed
strong.
It. And
like, it's
it
a strong,
strong
episode.
Episode.
Totally.
It was so nice to end the week on a strong
episode. On a really strong episode. Like, here is my big problem with the episode, and it's literally the only one. And it's about the tight timelines of the show. I literally don't believe that the guy had time to, after they killed that guy together, go out and find another woman to rape and stab to death. Like, I don't believe that.
Well, he is late getting home.
But it still doesn't matter. There's like no way he has time to go out and find a woman and stalk a woman and rape and murder a woman. Now, the weird part is there's a fix in the episode because they point out that they find out, right? That they find out that he, when he was killing on his own, he had an MO of raping and stabbing women. Yeah. But to please his wife, he has started using an MO that pleases her, which is to strangle people in front of her, right? Yeah. And then they have sex on top of the people's dead bodies. Which, oh God, I can't believe I had to say that. Thanks, show. But the point is...
And he has an STD.
Oh yeah, and he has an STD. But the point is, right, and this is what gets me, so it didn't have to happen last night. So let's say they assume that he's still being a scumbag and he used to get it. So what they should do is, there should have been a scene where they search for, instead of just searching for killers strangled and wrapped in...
shower curtains.
Shower curtains, they should have said, well, what about this other MO? That could be him too. Have there been any recent cases of stabbing and women who've been stabbed and raped, right? And then what you do is you have them find out that while he was working on the, while he was killing with her and doing the marriage counseling, he was also, air quotes, cheating on her by raping and stabbing other women. And so you would find that like 2 weeks ago he had killed a woman, and when they were having a bit of a tiff over the guy, he decides now is the time to give the necklace he took as a trophy off that other woman. Making it also happen the previous night is contrived nonsense, when just given what a scumbag this guy is, he could have killed that woman a couple of weeks ago and only just now given her the necklace because they were having a fight.
Yeah, but it's such a little thing.
Oh, no, it's not a big thing. It's just the timeline doesn't make sense because they already went out and killed a guy that night. And it's like, so he went out driving around and managed to find a woman to rape and murder another... and get away with?
No, like, I think, no. What's happening? This comes when you watch them too fast.
Okay.
Okay, so they kill the one guy.
Yes. Oh, you're right. He kills her the next day. You're
absolutely
right.
And then it's the next day, and I thought you were just... talking about
he absolutely kills her the next day. I was saying that wrong.
He kills the woman the next day, but the point is he gets a thing on his phone. Now the alert cannot be, now this is what I thought you were referring to, because this is what I thought. I'm going, wait a sec, the alert he gets on his phone has to be a job.
Yes, of course.
Right? So he's got to go out, do his tow job, then find a woman, kill her,
and then come home, and then it's still early enough that the two of them are going to go out and do a thing, you know?
And I'm going, wait a sec, but there doesn't seem to be, like, the timeline doesn't seem to be working here, that when he goes out to the target, he goes out to kill, and but he has to kill someone, now he's late. No, this is like, they're going to go out to a movie, so he's not supposed to be late, but he has to take this job, right? Because that's how he makes his money. But then he goes and rapes and kills someone. Not the necklace thing.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Right? Okay, in addition to the job, this was where I saw, and I'm going, okay, yeah, he was home, came home a little late, right? And she had left the phone, so he heard what was going on. But I'm still going, how, he had a job to do. And a tow truck job, even the shortest one,
it's
isn't
hours.
Like, I'm like, going, like,
you
to
drive
me, that...
to a place, you hook it up, you drive it to a garage or a yard, you take the person there to get them a cab. Like it's a long job.
Or it's
the
something
best
simple
times.
That he can fix, like, because, I mean, they do tow truck drivers will do minor jobs,
they will change your tire. They will change. They will break into your car. They will change your tire. They will do all of that stuff for you.
All these little things to get you back on the road again.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, honestly, it's not crazy if you lock your keys in your car. Yeah, a tow truck driver will show up and help you.
Yeah, but he had to stop. He was late for his wife because neither one of them would have been home when the FBI. If he hadn't stopped to go and rape and kill another woman, you know, he would have been home on time.
Yes.
And neither one of them would have been there when the FBI showed up. And it's just saying.
Oh, yeah.
See,
no, but I'm just saying it's like.
You get distracted by your hobbies. Oh, God, that was bad.
Yeah, that was pretty terrible. Yeah. But anyway.
Well, that seems to be the way they deal with this. Like, this is their hobby, almost. It's true. You know?
No, it is. I think it's absolutely right to describe it that way.
Yeah.
No, and it's a solid episode, you know? You've got the juxtaposition of trying to make a marriage work with the killing. Like, that all works. The husband that can't stop cheating on his wife, and they've expanded it to, like, the metaphorically out to serial killing. Like, it's all good stuff. It's all solidly written. Like I said, I just, I think it would have been more effective if he had just, like, if they had, rather than an extra woman been killed last night, they literally just had found that this woman had been killed using the same MO, right? That recently, and then they found a picture of her and she's got the necklace on. They're like, do, 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 do. And that'll help prove it to her.
Yeah, but
the thing that I don't get is, why on earth are you making a deal with this woman? They're like, we'll make a deal with you to reduce your sentence if you testify against your husband. Why? She is every bit as guilty as he is, and they have more than enough evidence to convict it, to send him away forever, because he literally talked about being a serial killer to his therapist and tried to strangle his therapist to death. They don't need the wife to testify against him. And it's like, and no, you should not be cutting this woman a break. She's every bit as bad as he is.
Yeah, I know. I think that, well, they wanted the whole dramatic interplay of her turning on her husband.
Yeah, and that's all well and good, but you don't need that, especially once you already know that the wife is wearing the necklace.
I'm like, not disagreeing.
All the proof you need.
I mean, because what I would say, no, that's her lawyer's job.
Yes,
and she has asked for a lawyer.
Yeah, you're right. They really shouldn't have kept talking to her after she asked for a lawyer.
She asked for a lawyer. And other times in this show, when somebody asks for a lawyer, they get out and then they have to come up with some finagle, you know?
Exactly. Whereas this time, it's like, no. The weird part is, they're in this kind of strange situation where
she can just plead.
Well, not only do they not need her, I don't know that they have any evidence against her.
Well, no, because she never killed anybody.
She never killed anybody. Like, they literally just have his word that she was involved. Like, remember we were talking about how, I can't believe I'm going back to the inspiration and the inspired, but there's that hilarious scene where it's like, where they bring down the father to identify which brother is which.
And
I'm like, because they have Hotch say that, I don't know if the audience is going to believe, the audience, oh my God, the jury is going to believe fingerprint evidence. We need the word of a schizophrenic to get this conviction.
Who's been crazy for 40 years.
For 40
years. For
30
years.
Whatever, however old the kid is, right? But the funny part is you watch that, right? But then you have an episode like this where it's like, literally the only evidence you have against his wife is your profile. You have no evidence against her.
No, there's no...
Like, there's no physical evidence against her. And even if the husband turns on her, which he might not, because he knows he's going away forever, and if he loves his wife at all, why not give her a pass? I don't know that this, as horrible as it is to think, I don't know that this woman's going to jail.
Well, I mean, I would have thought that she would just find herself another man.
Yeah, probably.
And get away with it. Because I'm trying to think. I mean, it depends on whether or not, like they have to make a connection.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about what you're saying, and I'm going, okay, even if her DNA is in the hotel room, doesn't matter.
Nope.
Even if her DNA is in the house, well, clearly it doesn't matter. And even if you find the DNA of that guy in their house, it's still doesn't matter. Because you'd have to find her DNA on
the guy,
him.
Which and there definitely isn't.
She never interacts physically.
That's my point. She doesn't
she doesn't even take them by the hand.
She never touches any of the victims.
No.
So the idea, like, they were obviously good enough at cleaning the place that I doubt that there's her DNA in the hotel room, right? But the weird part is, even if her DNA was in the hotel room, her lawyer has to do is say, She thought her husband was doing a sexy romantic thing of getting them a hotel room to get to have sex in. And it and she's been horrified to discover that the thing that got him off was knowing that there was a dead body in the closet while he was having sex with his wife on the bed.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally all his her lawyer has to say. And I think she's getting away with this.
Oh, sure.
It's a weird takeaway.
The DNA thing. Yeah, and it wouldn't even have to be that. He could have killed her. She might not even know that the girl was in the closet. She could just say, I didn't know.
You're right. No, you're right. She could even say, well, I only just now found out.
Yeah.
And like the worst thing, I mean, even if she has to admit that she knew there was a dead body, the worst they could get her on is like covering for her husband an accessory after the fact.
Yeah.
Because
they did only rent the hotel room for 24 hours because it was a mess the next day. So exactly. I was going to come up in my head, I'd come up with something else. And I'm going, no, that doesn't work because the desk clerk already said they were gone.
Exactly.
And the place was a mess.
And no one saw them with any of the victims. No. And the husband was the one picking up the victims most of the time. So there's no reason to assume she would have ever been witnessed. So yeah, like that's the weird takeaway at the end of this episode is I honestly believe that unless somehow the jury finds the fact that just Thomas Gibson gets on the stand and says, we believe that, you know, the reason his profile changed from raping and stabbing to strangulation was in a way to appease his wife who was standing there watching it. You know, there's no reason to believe that the jury will accept that. When the other option is this woman was deceived by her monster of a husband and she is another one of his victims. I feel like that's going to be the most compelling argument.
Come trial time, that's what her lawyer's going to, and that's what she's going to. Yeah. They needed this big scene, you know.
No, they need the big confrontation scene, and it's strange just because the more we talk about the episode, the more I realize, she's definitely not going to jail.
Well, that's what I thought. I can remember just thinking at the end, just off the cuff, she's going to get away with this.
Yeah, like, she really is. Because the weird part is, the only person who can convict her, right, is her husband. But that requires a jury to believe the husband over the wife.
Yeah.
But the husband's a rapist and a murderer.
And the thing is that all she has to say, okay, I mean, you see, and that's the whole thing. Because that was it when she sees the picture of the girl with the necklace. Yeah. And then she gets so mad at her husband, right?
Yep.
But that doesn't matter. That doesn't have to. That just means that she's so mad at him because he cheated on her and he raped and murdered this woman. It doesn't mean that she's mad because he cheated on her by killing somebody else.
Killing somebody without her. I mean, she can say, I was super pissed that what I thought was a beautiful anniversary gift was a trophy from his serial killing.
Yeah,
that's all you have to say. That I was shocked and horrified, and that's why I got angry at him and slapped him in the police station.
I mean, we're not lawyers, and we can write up her defense right now. You know?
So yeah,
she's not.
I don't know if the show thought about this as well as they should have.
Oh, come on. There isn't a lot that, I mean, I think even what they did isn't going to make any difference.
Oh, no,
I mean,
absolutely.
Except maybe it leaves the viewer with the idea that she's going to go to jail, but she's not.
No, she's definitely not going
to jail. I can't imagine that she's going to.
No, there's just no way
she's going to get her off with.
No.
Anything more than accessory after the fact, if that.
Because again, they would have to prove that she knew something or was there, and we have no reason to believe they have strong physical evidence that she was there.
Yeah.
Anyway. A strong episode, but also a very dark one now that we get to it.
Yeah. Really dark episode.
Super dark episode of the show.
Yeah.
All right.
But it is from beginning to end strong episode.
No, it's a very strong episode.
And it does.
I don't want to like create any other, like, I don't want to say that, downplay that at all. It's a very strong episode. The psychology works. The acting is great. You know, we both talked about the timeline thing, but the only truly upsetting thing about the episode is that maybe she gets away with it at the end.
And not for anybody's fault. Like, the BAU didn't do anything wrong.
It wasn't for a lack of trying. It's just these guys are good at murder.
Yeah, these guys were really, really good at murder.
Yeah.
You don't even have to make the argument that a jury wouldn't believe that a woman did it. No. There's no evidence. Like, as you say, I mean, when you think about it, there's no evidence against her.
Nope.
That you can make compelling.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, there's, like, no compelling case to be made against this woman.
Yeah.
And claim that she has some involvement in the case.
Yeah.
All right. So, that's horrifying. What are we going to... Let's wrap it up with a giving people their homework. What are we going to be watching next week?
We're going to watch Gabby.
I don't remember that episode at all. Like, what's the episode Gabby? Often the titles mean nothing to me in my defense.
No, I know it's the name of the... Anyway, when a 4-year-old Hattiesburg, Mississippi girl goes missing... While temporarily
saying, no! Yeah. Oh, this episode! Mm-hmm. All right, keep going.
The next one is Persuasion, when a Las Vegas, Nevada women are drowned and found.
Yep, the one about the mole people. Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. And then there's Rabid.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, you don't need to tell me which one Rabid is. It's the one about rabies. that one I got. Okay. It was funny because I was very proud of myself when I wrote the review of that one for, like, figuring out what was going on before the show told me. And then I found out later the episode is just called Rabbit. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I guess it wasn't that much of a surprise. It's weird because there was this very, as we've talked about the before, there's this very narrow window in the history of television when people didn't know what episodes of TV were called. Because, like, back in the day, from the start of television until about the 70s, they would very regularly put the title of the episode in front.
Yeah.
Right? And then through the 80s and 90s, they didn't do that. But then by the end of the 90s, DVR existed. And when you click on your DVR, it tells you the title of the episode.
Yeah, and sometimes that, I mean, and that is a problem because sometimes it does give away the...
Give away the twist.
Yeah, give away the twist. And, you know, so, but anyway, never mind.
No, this is going to, by the way, speaking of twists, we talked a little bit about Style Section, our upcoming Wise Guy podcast, which by saying over and over again, I'm just going to wish into existence, I think, apparently.
Apparently.
But anyway, if we've interested you in all watching Wise Guy, it's 99% of it is on Amazon Prime. So you can watch it right now. But, and I can't stress this enough, don't read the episode synopses. Like, do whatever you do. For some reason, these idiots over at Amazon Prime have put in episode synopses that spoil the entire plot of every episode.
Yeah, well, it would be great doing the sunny episodes.
That's what I'm saying. That's,
I mean, no, when I think about them, and we'll have to do the Kevin Spacey episodes and then Tim Curry episodes. And it's so nice. It was so nice to see Anthony Dennis.
Anthony Dennison, yeah.
Dennison, when what's his face was out for a while.
Out for a with while Jerry with a leg injury.
With Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis and Anthony Dennison, Ron Silver, and Stanley Tucci.
Unbelievable that segment.
What you have to understand about Wise Guy, if you start getting into it, is it has the most impressive cast a TV show has ever had.
Unbelievable.
You've never seen a better cast than you got in Wise Guy. Like, the people they got to be on this show.
And it's because
it's mind blowing.
You know what it is? I think that they got people. Well, they got a lot of people that we look at now. At the time, for example, Kevin Spacey. This was, I would say, his breakout role.
It was. Absolutely, it was his breakout role.
Anthony Dennison. Well, he'd been around, but
he had been on, and this is the key story about Anthony Dennison is he was the star of one of the stars of Police Story.
Yeah.
And Police Story had been a failure.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why they brought him back for this. And Wise Guy was the attempt to do Police Story right.
Yeah.
It was to fix Police Story.
Yeah.
And that is what Wise Guy was for. And it succeeded. And the thing about Wise Guy is, and this is, again, I know we're here to talk about Criminal Minds, but just one last thing. Wise Guy, in a very real way, invented modern prestige television. Right?
With, yeah, Cannell.
Before The Sopranos, what Cannell did with long-form storytelling, with complicated nuance, it is the most gray area show to have ever been broadcast on network television to that point.
And it is. And it is consistent. There's his mother. There's his brother. Then there's his stepfather. And like, I'm okay. You've talked me into it.
So look, we don't know when it's going to happen, but be on the lookout for Style Section.
We are going
Wise
to
Guy
finish.
Podcast.
We are
Criminal Minds first.
Criminal Minds first.
But then Style Section, the Criminal Mind, the Wise Guy Podcast. It's going to be exciting. All right. So I guess that's that. And, I don't know why I felt the need to talk you into this today, but apparently today was the day I decided to make that push.
Yes, you decided to make that push, and
it was the right day to spring it on you, I guess.
Clearly. because I've been thinking about even gone, like, I think it's probably the right day, because if I was to say anything about this season so far.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're now more than halfway through.
More than halfway through. We've only got 3 more episodes left of our show.
Of our show, yeah. So we've got sort of 9 episodes. Yeah, 9 episodes. Cause
8
this
or 9 episodes of the show, yeah.
4, I think. Yeah, it goes to 24. So there are 9 episodes left. And maybe this is where I start thinking, this show should have been much better than it was.
Yeah.
It could have been so much better. Because you see a whole bunch of episodes now after this, the disastrous opening 2 episodes.
As we've often said, among the worst things this show has ever done.
What?
No, the first 2.
Yeah, the first two. Yeah, don't mind. But you're looking at this and you're going, okay, there are some really good episodes. We haven't had a major issues with a lot of these episodes. They're easy fixes.
Yep.
If there had been a little bit more care, as far as I'm concerned, on the part of the showrunner, this show could have been really as good as the first 5 years or the first 4 years.
But so many people are phoning it in at this point.
Well, you know, the writers,
it has become a machine that runs itself.
Yeah, it's the writers and nobody's... Yeah. Really, it's just like, well, okay, guys, just do you think you're such great people and you're such wonderful writers.
We need 50 pages by Friday, and as long as it's 50 pages, we'll shoot it.
Yeah.
You know, that is how much work they're putting
But that does appear because somebody, I mean, I've complained before about continuity. I've complained before about the fact that they don't have script editors.
Yeah.
That because I would assume a really good script editor would pick up little things. Yeah. If there was an overall comprehensive view of the show.
Yeah.
And as I said, it would be wonderful to find out just how many people. Because remember, I went through that period of going, frig, are they all Scientologists?
I know.
Oh, by the way, Scientology has basically bought up almost all of Clearwater, Florida.
Famously,
were there, and they have just silently under the table been buying out all of the properties in Clearwater, Florida, or all the businesses and all of these major.
Yeah, but that's a project L. Ron Hubbard started himself back in the
70s. Oh, yes.
And
yes.
I guess they've finished the job finally.
Yeah. And sometimes they've paid as much as 4 times the property value.
Because they were desperate to have a city that's all their own. Yeah. Like the Mormons did in Utah.
Yeah.
It's exactly like what the Mormons did in Utah. The difference is, of course, that they're doing it in a place where there's already civilization, whereas Utah was just a desert.
Yeah, and they created Utah, basically.
Yeah,
whereas they've taken over, supposedly, Clearwater, Florida. And I'm sitting there going, okay, so they're going to take over Florida. That's their plan. Okay.
What? All right.
There's a Lots of salsa music.
It's going to be, since we've moved into talking about, if there's ever a sign for when it's time to stop, it's when we start talking about Scientology.
Yes.
I think that's a general rule. I think that should be our little clue. Speaking of, the Millennium episode about Scientology is one of the best hours of television I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
But that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Anyway, more importantly, though, you can join us back here next week for episodes 916 to 918. That should be a lot of fun, especially that episode about the kidnapped little girl. We are going to have a lot to talk about. Oh,
there's so
episode.
Many things wrong with it, but it's so sad.
Oh, it's sad. Well, you know what? It goes to your theory.
Yes. Okay.
It definitely goes to your theory about the show, about the rules of the Criminal Mindsiverse.
Yeah, there aren't that many, but there are some.
They exist. So join us back here for that. If you have any questions for us, if you have any suggestions, if you have some profiling-related fiction you think we should check out, drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. So we will see you back here next week for that. But until then, I'm going to say au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.